World War I has gone down in history as an unnecessary bloodbath of huge proportions. But one man turned it around, the Jewish Australian field commander John Monash. The German historian Dieter Blau blamed the carnage on the outdated methods of the high command of both sides. Blau argued that the Allies had the only man who could win the war. Quote, "He proved it on Saint-Quentin Heights, at Villers-Bretonneux, at Hamel Hill, and on the Hindenburg Line. His name was Monash, a Jew of German extraction, from Australia." Historian and Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Beth Israel in Melbourne, Rabbi John Levi, tells us about John Monash.
His grandfather was a very famous printer of Hebrew books and prayer books and Talmuds and all sorts of things. In Europe, he worked terribly hard, had a large family, had to provide dowries for all his daughters, which was a great financial strain. And so son Louis took off and came to Australia. He and Bertha, his wife, had only recently come to Victoria when John was born. So the family remained German-speaking, but the family actually came from Poland.
Well, it sounds like he had a fairly good Jewish pedigree. Was John himself involved in Jewish activities?
He had a marvelous Jewish pedigree because his uncle, by marriage, was the most famous Jewish historian, Heinrich Goetz. And Goetz's History of the Jew was absolutely pioneering, a multi-volume book published in numerous languages. When Monash was bar mitzvah, they gave this 13-year-old a set of Goetz's History of the Jews in French, which Monash could read. So here he was in an English-speaking country, fluent in three languages by the time he was 13.
Well, shades of brilliance to come, I guess. But of course, he's remembered today because of his successful command as Lieutenant General in charge of the AIF in World War I. And yet he wasn't even a career soldier. Was there any resistance to his appointment?
Well, of course, the professionals always resist the amateur. Although Monash had been a conscientious member of the citizen military force from an early age, he really enjoyed, at university, his military activities, the civilian side of the military. And they had games and they had mock battles and so on. And Monash was very much in that. But he was just absolutely brilliant. And his brilliance, really, was his organizational ability. By the way, although he's remembered as the great military hero, I think his enormous achievement was the planning and establishment of the electricity grid for the whole of southeastern Australia. And that was based on the brown coal deposits in Gippsland.
Now, he was actually a student of engineering, civil engineering?
Yes. Well, according to Geoffrey Searle, his university education was very bumpy. He actually failed one year. He had terrible trouble with Latin. And Latin was essential in those days. You couldn't have a tertiary degree without Latin. So it was his bugbear, but of course he did. He ended up as an engineer. He was very good at maths.
Now, he was second to General Douglas Haig in World War I. But I gather many people thought Monash was the better man.
Absolutely, but he was a colonial, and he was an amateur soldier, and he hadn't gone to the best military schools in England. So it was impossible to imagine that Monash was superior to Haig. They're very close in age, really. Haig was a very conventional soldier, and he believed, as the Germans did, in throwing men against each other and seeing who came out the best, how many casualties you can inflict. Monash wasn't like that. Monash organized things. He knew, it was like a chess game, that you didn't have to bash your enemy up infinitely and see who was standing in the end. He knew it was a matter of tactics. He had a grasp of what would be happening months ahead of any given situation.
What were his great military successes?
Oh, it was undoubtedly in the latter stages of the war. He could plan months ahead what would be happening at the front. I have a story from the diaries of Rabbi Jacob Dangler, who was the Jewish chaplain on the front, who came to Monash in July in 1918 asking whether Monash could attend the High Holiday services, which would be in September. And he looked at the map and he worked out exactly what would happen. He said, oh yes, we'll be there by then. So he knew months ahead where the front line would be. And it was this mastery of the game that was his greatness. And of course, he was an engineer. So he was used to getting all your assets together and being able to put them in the right place. It was typical. He had, of course, proved his worth at Gallipoli. I don't think Haig was an opponent of his. He was just there as the senior man because he had the background.
And I guess the king supported Haig.
Yes, that's true. Of course, this was an imperial army.
But when it came to Lloyd George, I think the opinions differed.
Yes. Well, Lloyd George is a very interesting character. He was imbued with the spirit of the Old Testament. He knew his Bible backwards. He would have had no problems whatsoever with a Jewish general.
Well, he was knighted, finally, at the end of the war. Was that in the field?
Yes, it was in the field, and it was the first time that a commanding officer had been knighted for 200 years by the monarch. So that was a very important event. However, the government also felt that, and they really worked out a job for Monash in Europe after the war so that he didn't come home immediately because he was too powerful a figure on the Australian scene, regarded with enormous respect. So they kept him busy in England for a year, supervising the repatriation of soldiers, so that the market wasn't flooded with young, vigorous men looking for work at all the same time.
Well, when he returned to Australia, I think there was some thought that he might be the Governor General.
They didn't know what to do with him. Not only that, he really didn't have a pension. There was no provision for this great man to be able to live independently. So he had to earn his living, which wasn't a bad thing in the end, but it must have been a terrible come down.
I gather in the contest for the Governor General, it was quite unusual, really, that the two candidates were Jews.
Yes, but this is much later. This is 1930, and of course he came back to Australia 10 years before and had to find work as an engineer and finally as the director of the Electricity Commission. In 1930, we had a Labour government. Of course, the Depression was hitting Australia much harder than it hit other industrialised countries because we were basically the breadbasket. We produced the raw materials. So when there was a recession in Europe, nobody wanted to buy our stuff. And Australia faced enormous trauma because of this. There's a hand of John Monash behind this, obviously, in Melbourne, where he designed the Shrine of Remembrance, not the actual shape, but the place where it should be. They used the unemployed ex-servicemen to build the hill on which the Shrine of Remembrance stands. And that's Monash's enduring monument. And it was also a practical way of dealing with the problem of the unemployed. And that was typical of Monash. Monash wasn't offered the Governor Generalship. It was Isaac Isaacs, who, after all, had been the Chief Justice, two Jewish men who hardly knew each other. They didn't have much in common, except they were both geniuses. And their paths didn't cross very often, and they certainly had a very different concept of their Jewishness.
Monash was certainly much more open about his support of the Zionist cause, whereas Isaac Isaacs was a sharp critic of it.
Yes. Well, Monash's name didn't say, "I'm Jewish." Isaac Isaac's name certainly did. And people are now surprised to find out that John Monash was Jewish. Don't forget this, the Jewish community was so small. When the Zionist movement in Australia asked him to become their president, honorary president, he agreed. And he took the job quite seriously. In 1929, when the British interfered with the way in which Jews prayed at the Western Wall, the so-called Wailing Wall, and where there had been pogroms against the Jews, and the British government had not prevented these happening, the massacre in Hebron, the Jews of Melbourne organised a protest meeting in the Melbourne Town Hall that Monash chaired. He didn't hesitate to do that, whereas Isaac Isaacs couldn't imagine that anything under the British Empire could ever be unjust, and he was very disturbed by this. Monash had no inhibition. Monash had tilted at the establishment ever since he got back from Europe.
Well, speaking of that trait, I recall that the great war correspondent, C.W. Bean, was very critical of Monash. He initially did not want him, a Jew, to be the head of the AIF.
Absolutely. Bean finally realized that he was up against a giant, but there was this sort of looking down superior attitude to Monash the Jew. But Monash's Jewishness never stood in his way, because he rose to the highest rank, just on merit.
Well, Monash died in 1931, but his grave is so bare, there was no mention really of who he was, in contrast to the Australian War Memorial, where he is regarded as arguably Australia's most famous soldier.
Monash arranged for the gravestone of his wife, and his instructions to the synagogue was that the inscription and the gravestone should be of the simplest possible style, without ostentation. Now, there was certainly an ostentatious side to Monash, but the Jews of Australia really lived on the principle that you don't do anything to upset the apple cart.
Are you saying you don't draw attention to yourself?
Exactly. And that was sort of ingrained in the whole of the Jewish community in those years, in the 20th century. The Bulletin had fiercely criticized the Jews and printed terrible cartoons by people like Lindsay. Smith's Weekly was always having a go, but both papers made Monash an exception. But Monash's inclination would be that any monument would be unostentatious. However, when he died, hundreds of thousands of people lined the street from Parliament House in the centre of Melbourne to the cemetery in Brighton. It was the largest public demonstration of affection Australia ever saw.
Well, I think Neville Rann said at the Great Synagogue Centenary Dinner in Sydney in the 1970s, with the exception of modern Israel itself, only one nation in more than 2,000 years has called upon Jews to be head of its armies, head of its judiciary, and twice head of state: John Monash, Isaac Isaacs, and Zelman Cowan. That's an extraordinary record. Do you think that those sorts of choices would be made today?
I think so. I think that these were choices made on merit. I think that it was an extraordinary historical fact that right from the beginning of European settlement in Australia, the Jews were treated without the burden of history that Jews had to face in Europe. Australia is the true meritocracy. We mightn't have a Bill of Rights, but we certainly have a tradition of a fair go.
And I guess John Monash symbolized that.
Yes, there was another footnote to Monash's life which is very remarkable, and that is, with the Great Depression, the veterans in Australia decided that we'd be much better off organized militarily. After all, the black shirts were in Italy, fascism was alive and well in Europe. This seemed to be the way out of the financial crisis that gripped the globe, and the ex-servicemen approached Monash, in all seriousness, in 1930, to become the military dictator of Australia. In Europe, those fascist dictatorships turned to anti-Semitism, although Mussolini wasn't anti-Semitic at the beginning. This became a characteristic of what happened and is happening in Europe. In Australia, those same forces turned to a Jewish Australian to become the dictator. And Monash said, "I didn't fight," not exact words, but, "I didn't fight against the Kaiser in the First World War to overturn the ballot box in Australia." And I think that's one of the great statements of Australian history.
How fortunate for us that Sir John Monash had no delusions of grandeur. Historian and Rabbi Emeritus of Temple Beth Israel in Melbourne, John Levi.